Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
And I'm David Goldstein. It's Monday morning, November 8th. This is the day in which there's going to be a full-on vaccine clinic at my daughter's school. How awesome is that? Three cheers for modern medicine and technology. And what's even better than that is that you're listening to The Drop.
Right. And with that, Dave's daughter is suddenly able to see indoor concerts. She's been waiting on this since winter 2019-2020. I cannot wait to hear what the first show that Hannah's going to go to. My son is about to get vaccinated as well. This is amazing.
We're hoping it's a Heim show. Heim got to play some indoor shows. Want that to be Hannah's like first show she can sing along to. So if you're out there, Heim, come to New York, do a three-night run at Radio City. We'll go.
That'd be pretty incredible. And it is Monday, November 8th. We are firmly into November. It's the final full month of fall. Anyone who's been listening to The Drop knows, like, I just love this time of year. My yard is covered in leaves. I'm about to rake a bunch. The trees are barren. There's frost on the ground in the morning. I'm just... I love it. I always forget the best sunrises and sunsets in Denver happen during November. It's a strange, whatever's happening outside in the weather, we just get this crazy light in the morning, beautiful sunsets at night. I'm happy with where we are. We're seeing the end of 2021 coming at some point. BBB and Biff will pass. I don't know when, but at some point it will. But for now, we are in drop land. David, tell me how your last week has been.
Last week was pretty good. Fall has really finally hit in New York City, talking like 45 degrees in the morning, crispness. We wake up at 7, the sun is rising, then daylight savings is going to hit, and we're going to wake up when it's bright out, which is good, but it means it's going to get dark at 4:45, which is kind of annoying. But I've been pretty good. I saw a Garcia People show last week at the Sultan Room in Bushwick, Brooklyn. They're doing, it was the first night of their residency, so it's going to be, I think, each Wednesday They've done two of them. I'm going to try to go to third, but a big tour schedule has made them really tight and fun and interesting. So if you hear this and you can get to the Sultan on a Wednesday, check that out. And the Braves won the World Series. That's all I got to say about that.
I'm glad the Braves won instead of the Astros, even though I didn't really want to see the Braves win. I realized towards the end of Game 6 that despite not enjoying the Braves organization or many of their fans, there were a lot of players on this team that were likable. It was one of those weird, scrappy October teams that it's kind of the only sport where you can get a team like this. I guess football is similar. You think about that 9-7 Giants team that figure out a way to win Super Bowl 46. But like baseball is just classic at a team that looks completely out of it in July and early August, giving you names like Eddie Rosario,
Jorge Soler,
Jock Peterson, you know, the last two being former Cubs that I was very happy for. But Freddie Freeman seems like a solid dude. Was happy to see him win a World Series, potentially maybe a free agent.
Freddie Freeman's not going anywhere. Like, he's going to be a Brave for life. He's the new Chipper Jones. He's old school.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the impression you get. But they had one of those teams that shouldn't win a World Series, somehow won a World Series, and it's much preferable to them winning a World Series to the Astros. But knowing that you are a Mets fan and knowing that I'm basically going on in the way that you would, as though this were the Cardinals, why don't we move on from the Braves winning the World Series and talk about the other incredible thing that happened in the last week, which was Fish's Las Vegas Halloween run.
Gosh, quite a run it was. I will say my sleep pattern still haven't gotten back to normal because I've been several weeks during the Fish shows on the East Coast, staying up to like 1:30 in the morning. So I figured, great, when it's over, I'll be lights out by 11:15. And I do that and just lie there in the dark and think like, wow, I really haven't adjusted to like going to bed at a normal time anymore. So now I'm just going to be awake. But let's see. October 28th, that was my favorite night of the four. The numbers theme was very cool, and the opening 2001 into 1999 was probably my favorite 25, 30 minutes of the entire long weekend, just because that's got jammy jams to spare.
Yeah, that show had the shock value. The first set was absolutely incredible. I've said it in other places, but I'll say it again here. The ability for them to use a gimmick, combining it with a set list, combining it with jams, was very reminiscent of the 831-2012 Fuck Your Face show. And I didn't think that they had it in them to really play a show like that again. I didn't think that they were ever going to go for like a gag set list. But it's really cool to look at that set list and think that the band... Basically, you know, we had the Thank You Encore from 2015 at Dick's. We had the Lushington first set. But really, since the Most Shows Spell Something Backwards show from Dick's Friday night in 2013, the band hasn't attempted a full show gimmick and kind of set list gag like this. And it was crazy to see them go after it again and have it work in the level that it did. Musically, they nailed it. The two versions of Me Jam, not only seeing two versions of Me return, but also seeing that jam into NO2. First Tube had a jam. Great 7 Below jam, great If 6 Was 9 debut and then jam. I mean, just 20 years later, I mean, so many jams scattered everywhere.
Yeah, serious improv. Obviously, they planned the set list out in advance, but it completely worked for them in this instance. And then the hits kept coming with the Friday night show, October 29th. Another incredible first set. I mean, just look at the times of Live Fish. They jammed out Excellent Part 2. B, they took the Don't Shine That Thing in My Face, Man, and stretched that out to like what, like 15, like 14, 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was incredible improv on that Friday. I mean, you could argue that this Thursday and Friday were, you know, two incredibly good back-to-back shows. Maybe some of the best back-to-back they played this fall. I might have liked San Francisco night 1 and 2 a little bit better, but that's, you know, it's entirely subjective. Extremely good stuff.
Yeah, I think that Friday night being the only show that seemingly didn't have a gimmick associated with it.
Right.
Worked as just a very solid Fish show. The first set, like you said, Axela Part 2 jamming. That's a dream moment. The Mikes and Weekapog both were incredible. I Always Wanted It This Way set closer. And then in set two, you know, on first listen, I'll fully admit, I kind of thought there was a little bit too much jumping around, and I re-listened to it and I was like, no, it's a really fluid second set. And, it works.
Really good tweezer for just like 20 minutes.
Really good tweezer. Very good tweezer. Really good tweezer. You know, really incredible, Sigma Oasis and Walk Away to conclude. Great sand. It just, it worked really well. Great Reba midway through the second set. So, I greatly enjoyed this show, and I would agree with you. It's up there with the Shoreline shows that we heard this summer as potentially the best two night run that we've heard from Fish since 2004. Type two ass handed. Yeah. I didn't even mention that. Just incredible. Incredible moments. And I calculated it. Ass Handed is usually about a minute long. It turned out to be about 6.5 minutes long. So if the average Fish jam, let's say give or take, is 15 minutes long, this is as though Fish played a 90-minute jam, which let's just agree that's something that Fish 4.0 could and should try to do. We moved on to the final night prior to Halloween, the third night of the show, third night of the run. This was Animals Night. This was, I felt, the equivalent in setlist form of the weight joke, which the band used to do in clubs, where they would play a familiar riff with kind of mistakes riddled through it, and then Trey would step to the mic and go, wait, and then they'd attempt it again, and he'd step to the mic and go, wait. And then they'd attempt it again. And they do this, so on and so forth, to the point that, like, you had people in the audience being like, play the fucking song! And it was just, like, a way to, like, kind of test the audience. That's kind of what Animals Night felt like to me. It was just like, okay, we get it. We get the joke. We get the joke. We get the joke. And yet they continue to do it. Great Your Pet Cat, though.
Yeah.
And great Harpoon.
I enjoyed it. I don't think I got to listen back to it too often.
Right.
It was a little cute, you know. This is Fish. They've earned the right after all these years to be cute.
Right.
Not knocking it. Also, holy shit, this Fish have a lot of songs named after animals. Like,
they left some on the table.
You, me, and you, me, and Josh Carver, shout out Nola Sox, were like texting back and forth like all the songs that could be animals. Yeah. And they didn't play like half those songs. Right. Like, there's a lot of animal songs that didn't make the cut for whatever reason. But yeah, Good Your Pet Cat. Actually, very good Birds of a Feather.
Yeah.
It's only 8.5 minutes. It packs a lot of interestingness into the 8.5 minutes. Kind of like the second set, The Runaway Gym, Piper, Birds of a Feather was all pretty solid.
Totally.
But at the same time, it's shit, man. There's a lot of 6-minute songs about animals and Fish's repertoire.
There are. Yeah, I mean, it felt like it in times, and I think that we'll get into it here in a second, but like by the time the Halloween show ended, okay, it made more sense what they did. The Harpua made more sense. But it was a lot. It was a lot to get to that. I'm curious what they thought when they were walking on stage and were like, hey, are we going to play 14 songs this set? We haven't really been doing that this tour. Like, what's been working is playing like half of that, if not less. So, let's just run with it. 10:31 Halloween. First Halloween in 3 years. There's a lot of controversy around this show, which I think we should note is nothing new. I can't think of a single Halloween that I have experienced with Fish going back to 2009 that has not had controversy. Even Exile on Main Street, I remember there were people in the community going, oh, this is so lame. What a standard rock album. Why are they doing this? Oh, they don't have a second guitarist.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's just, no matter what the band does, there's going to be kind of aggravation. So I the controversy to me seems pretty standard, but also I think Fish did take a pretty big risk in terms of what they did on Halloween. I think it worked really well. I really enjoyed the Halloween set. What did you think, Dave?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I would say I wouldn't expect these songs to quite enter the rotation like the Kazovac songs. I think there's maybe four or five things that I would enjoy hearing again. I really kind of wanted to hear the crazy, dark, yelling, psychedelic madness of Egg in a Hole. I'd like to hear that, or Carini, or Dark Egg in the Hole Jam. What was most interesting about this is that you can absolutely hear snippets of where a lot of like the 4.0 jams came from. Like, I forget where it was at one point in the song. I said, oh yeah, okay, this is the genesis of like the last 6 minutes of the Tweezer from Atlanta, just over the summer.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, it was clearly, you would listen to it and you'd say, okay, this definitely sounds like a 4.0 version of Kazovac. And to the extent that, so I think some of the controversy stems from the fact that some people thought that it kind of hewed a bit too close to Kazovac in the sense of making an entirely collaborative new album based on these alter egos. It kind of seems like a rehash of what they did back in 2018. However, I would argue this was darker, angrier, a little more psychedelic, a little more like, kind of reminded me of the Flaming Lips album Embryonic from a few years ago. Yeah, in terms of, I don't know what it's got for replay value, but you know, in the moment, watching it on television with the Power Rangers costumes, I thought it was well done and extremely fishy. Whether you liked it or not, you can't deny the fact that they're still the only band capable of doing this.
Yeah, and I felt like the only thing I would add to it is I felt that there was a lot of testament to their heroes. You know, I heard attempts to reach Genesis era or Gabriel era Genesis. Yes. Early Floyd, King Crimson. I don't think that they fully reached, I want to be clear. And I think that that's one of the like fascinating things about Phish, is that at the end of the day, they remain Phish. They are goofy, upper middle class, white suburban dudes born in the 1960s who have been informed by classic rock radio, the internet, kind of ironic, sarcastic humor that dominated in the 90s when they had their peak artistic period. And all of that kind of comes out even in the, when they do like a testament to their interpretations or to their inspirations. So I loved it in that standpoint. To me, the run of songs from Clear Your Mind through The Unwinding was really, really strong.
Clear Your Mind. Clear Your Mind,
which I saw someone on Twitter just before we recorded said that Clear Your Mind is just basically a Bachman Turner Orchestra song with different lyrics. And I was like, man, I love it even more. Like, anytime Phish writes songs that should be on 70s classic rock radio, I'm here for it.
Bachman Turner Overdrive, Taking Care of Business. Yes. All right. Hell yeah.
Yes.
Also, the first set and the third set from that show was really good. Like, huge 28-minute ghost, lots of ideas. And suck it, Soul Planet haters, that Soul Planet in the third set is the oral equivalent of an awesome pinball machine. I thought that was a great jam.
The second they get into a Soul Planet jam, they're just like, they're in outer space. It's fascinating. Yeah. Like, I remember reading somewhere that they've cut down like three quarters of the song. Paige used to have a solo at some point. There was like another verse. It's like they just use Soul Planet as a way to almost like troll fans and then just dive off into type two space.
It's great. They don't always say the wind is the music and don't always say the ocean is love.
Right.
Sometimes they'll just sing two verses and say, fuck it.
So on the whole, I think we both agree. This was a really strong New Year's, this was a really strong Halloween run. I'm really excited to see where this takes the band as they move into New Year's, as they move into Mexico, and kind of wherever we find them here going forward. I think the last thing I'll say about it, fascinating to me that we have we have the sounds of 2021 in song in the same way that the story of the ghost gave us the sounds of 1997 in song. And that is something that will stay with us for the remainder of Phish's career. And it's fascinating. Jumping off from Phish, we have some new singles, new album announcements. Spoon just announced a new album, Lucifer on the Sofa, as well as Spiritualized announced Everything Was Beautiful, both have released lead singles. They both sound fantastic. They sound very classic in terms of Spoon, as well as in terms of Spiritualized. Very, very excited for those. As we've noted here, Jason Pierce, the mind, the creator behind Spiritualized, has revealed clearly that he is a Kurt Vonnegut fan, which listeners of this podcast will know has deep meaning for me. And the Everything Was Beautiful combines with Everything Was Beautiful and Nothing Hurt, the title of his 2018 record, to be a quote from Slaughterhouse-Five, which I absolutely love the fact that these are going to be both companion pieces and also a nod to Slaughterhouse-Five.
Yeah, I'm excited for both of these records. The new Spoon single, The Heart Is Cut, is great. It's got a nice ZZ Top boogie guitar solo. Definitely has a good Texas feel to it. The latest Spiritualized single, it starts quiet and builds like you want Spiritualized to. And the Spiritualized track list is very funny. I think there's a song in it called The Mainline Song. There's a song in parentheses, it's like the D song, the A song, which I'm guessing means it's in like A major and D major. But, you know, Jason Pierce likes having silly track listings with more parentheses than a U2 album. So, very much looking forward to both of those. I know I'm looking at Brian right now in the Zoom window wearing his Chicago Bulls cap. I have to buy a Knicks hat. I don't have one. But the Bulls and Knicks have been surprisingly enjoyable at the start of the NBA season so far. Although I see the Knicks kind of retreating back to, they're going to go back to the mean. They weren't going to be, I mean, they came out of the gates blazing 5-1, but there was they'll be fighting for the sixth seed all season, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so when we first started Beyond the Pond, the Bulls made a shocking run to the playoffs that year with Rajon Rondo, Jimmy Butler, and Dwayne Wade, a team I absolutely hated. I hated everything about that season. We won two games in Boston. Everybody thought we were about to upset the Celtics, and then we got swept the remainder of the series. Since then, we blew it up, traded Jimmy Butler, and probably the franchise has made so many insanely dumb moves throughout my lifetime, but probably the dumbest move of them all. Drafted Lauri Markkanen as a result of it, brought back Chris Dunn and Zach LaVine, and have tried to rebuild around Zach LaVine as the core in the most miscast role possible. I could go on and on. I'm not going to. All I'm going to say is since we started Beyond the Pond, the Bulls have been an absolute train wreck. We had Jim Boylan, the worst coach in NBA history, coaching us for two seasons. For some reason, we wouldn't fire Gar Pax, our tag team front office duo. We've finally gotten a solid front office. We brought over the GM from the Nuggets. We hired Billy Donovan, a very smart, competent coach. We've traded well. We've signed free agents. We are having the best season that we have had thus far since the 2014-2015 season. I love DeMar DeRozan in a way that I did not expect. I love Lonzo Ball. I love watching him play basketball. Until we figure out, and until this team figures out that Zach LaVine is not a number one option, he is a number three option on a great team. And that's the role he should be in. He should not be the number one guy on this team. Stop it. Stop it. Our cap with him at the number one option, the best case scenario is us being a fifth seed. I still have us picked as a play-in team. I think that we're going to fall off hard, especially with this West Coast road trip. But you know what the cool thing is? We've been complaining about the Cubs and the Mets throughout the spring, summer, and fall since we started recording Beyond the Pond and since we started doing the drop. Now we get to do it in the winter about the Bulls and the Knicks. So I'm excited about that, if nothing else.
One of these days, there's going to be a knock on your door, and it's going to be Zach LaVine coming to kick your ass.
I'm okay with it.
Because he says, I've listened to every episode of The Drop, and all it is you hating on me. Let's see you in the slam dunk contest.
That's buddy. It. He's a slam dunk contest winner. There's nothing else. There's nothing else. We will continue this conversation throughout the season because it's clear I have thoughts.
Yeah. My Knicks fandom, NBA fandom, doesn't quite run as deep as yours, except to say that this is probably the most enjoyable Knicks team since the Linsanity era.
Yeah.
Good young role players. young role players. RJ Barrett's going to grow into being a stud. There's some good veteran leadership. There's a nice hometown hero now with Kemba Walker, who's actually doing some good draining of some three-point shots. It's fun. And Tom Thibodeau, as you know, he's got them playing very hard. And
amazing coach.
When you do good things for Thibodeau, you get rewarded by being in his rotation. You feel good.
Right.
So it's, I'll be happy with 5-3 right now.
Yeah.
But moving on.
So before we get into the big discussion of the week, we are going to recommend two podcasts from Osiris Media that we hope that you listen to. Dave, what do you got? What are you encouraging listeners to check out from Osiris?
I'm a little biased here, but as you know, both Brian and myself, Brian more so, worked to put together the Undermine podcast. We took a two-week break when Fish was on tour, but we just came back with episode 7. Which is called Set Break, and this is probably my favorite episode of the season, and the fact that it explores spirituality in Fish, it explores being sober in Fish, so there's exploration of psychedelics, spirituality, and sobriety, and I'm a little biased because I conducted two of the interviews, which make up about a good like 15 minutes of the episode. And I'm extremely happy with how it came out. And just in terms of, I'll give a little hint, a little bit what it's about. There's a large section on Judaism, in particular how things like Jewish summer camp and Jewish youth groups and sort of like Reformed Jews looking for some kind of form of like spirituality, why there's so many Jews that seem to enjoy Fish, myself among them. And that was just... really excellent section. A lot of it included our good buddy Jay Cohen, who we had on Beyond the Pond to talk about the Boise AC/DC bag a while ago. So I'm in love with the series and thought this one was really well done, and you can catch up with it if you haven't yet, but as a standalone episode, episode 7 works as well.
I would agree. I loved the way episode 7 came through, and the goal that we had of trying to tackle the spiritual nature of a Fish show through varying ways that people get there was something I felt was a huge accomplishment. Big shout out to Benji Eisen. I am going to recommend the final episode of the Breaking Waves series. I am again showing a little bit of bias here because I worked on this, but episode 4, Can You Hear Us? The New Puget Sound. Really fantastic conclusion to an incredible 4-part series about the rise of grunge, the impact of grunge, the impact of Seattle on American culture, and then what happened when the scene started to dissipate, when, as is said throughout the show, the vampires came in and started sucking up all the opportunities musically and culturally within Seattle, and then where are we at today? And this episode was really a fascinating look at where Seattle has been since basically the end of the 90s. And it makes you really, really realize like how many artists you listen to who have come from Seattle who have nothing to do with grunge. We heard from Perfume Genius. We heard from Ben Gibbard. We talked about Fleet Foxes. I mean, there was so much music that came out of Seattle in the 2000s that really informed indie rock and indie pop at the time. And the series kind of ends with a look at Aaron Jones, who is one of the best rising singer-songwriters in Seattle. We hear from Eva Walker as well as Joss Rosenfeld, who is one of the label executives in Seattle, who's really pushing these younger artists. I got to do an interview with Sir Mix-a-Lot for this episode, which was a fascinating, incredible opportunity, who talked a lot about where hip hop and rock are kind of, you know, fusing in Seattle in a really fascinating way. So it asks a really interesting question about what happens to scenes 20, 30 years after the fact. Can there be another wave that comes? And that was always kind of a really fascinating question that we considered in the pre-production of this series. Two big shout outs just from my end. Jim Allen, the writer for the show, did an incredible job crafting together this through line and this narrative, taking a ton of interview content and figuring a way to tell this incredible story. And huge shout out to Brad Stratton, the editor, producer, executive producer of the show. I'd never worked with Brad before this show, and the opportunity to work with someone who truly understands how to take a wild idea for a show, condense it down, and then make it into a reality that sounds just lush and beautiful, and it's something you just want to live in for each hour that it's out, and then go back and live in it again, is a huge accomplishment. So Undermine Episode 7, as well as Breaking Waves Episode 4, we are recommending. And now, let's get to the big topic of the week. All right. So it is Monday, November 8th. If you listen to The Drop, if you listen to Dave and I, if you've listened to us for the last couple of years, there's one thing that's been missing from this show. There's one thing that we haven't...
Twiddle?
There's one thing that we haven't talked about. There's one thing that, for whatever reason... we've been silent on it. I don't really know why. Have we been suffering over it? Have we been thinking of a place to talk about it? Have we been looking for the best night to have this discussion? Have we felt under the pressure to talk about this? If you, dear listener...
we've been looking for the perfect ocean. The perfect ocean between the waves to talk about this.
I'll tell you, my eyes have been red trying to figure out how to talk about this. And I've been burning... trying to figure out where we're going to do this. And so we're going to do it right now. It's a week and change since the War on Drugs put out their fifth album, I Don't Live Here Anymore. And we had it tacked up that we would do our costume episode last week, where we'd give you all BTP once again. And that this week we would come back and we would talk about the War on Drugs and give a full perspective of where the War on Drugs are at within their career, do a deep dive, and then talk about the new album, I Don't Live Here Anymore. David, before we jump into the records, try to tell me just kind of broad picture, what does the War on Drugs mean to you?
The War on Drugs is basically everything I heard in my parents' car in childhood, blown up widescreen and funneled through me, that represents driving and freedom and rock and roll and epicness and kind of just a mind meld of everything that I've enjoyed in my 42 years. And Adam Granshaw, the frontman, is also 42 years old, so I have to feel that he probably listened to the same stuff I listened to and feels the same way and understands the power of listening to music on the car radio and driving very fast and just saying, yes, this is what all music should do. It should make me feel as good as the best War on Drugs songs make me feel. It's really uncanny how much this band dips into everything I like in my brain pan. Right down the shoegaze music. Shoegaze, 80s epics, Springsteen, you name it. So
yeah, I'm right there with you on pretty much all of that. It's, there's a lot of nostalgia when I listen to the War on Drugs, but it's blown up and it's distilled in a way that the music that Adam is communicating couldn't be delivered in its first dosage. You kind of needed him to mash up albums like Brothers in Arms, Tunnel of Love, Infidels, Southern Accents. You name it, even trans to a certain degree, and then dip into shoegaze in a lot of cases. When I describe the type of music I like to listen to, it usually comes down to the War on Drugs. And as we're going to dive into here, their five records have shown an evolution, a commitment to a sound, persistence, and also an ability to tinker with things in really brilliant ways that gives you five albums that sound very much a part of themselves, very much like a process that Adam has been going through for the last 15 odd years that just seems to work in a really, really fascinating musical way. So we're going to dive into each of these records, kind of go over our thoughts on them leading up to I Don't Live Here Anymore. So Dave, give me kind of your breakdown of Wagon Wheel Blues, the very first War on Drugs album.
Wagon Wheel Blues is very good, but it's also, it plants the seed in what they would become. I don't think it ultimately sounds like what the man in the street thinks of the War on Drugs. Like, all the sound is there. He has the big epic classic rock sound that's in his head, but it's a lot yelpier than future War on Drugs records. He does a lot more of kind of like a yelpy Rolling Thunder review era Dylan, and the lyrics touch upon much less of his themes and more of, I don't want to use the word a little bit of like a Dylan pastiche. And for some reason, there's not much in the way of bass on the album. So kind of the album cover is like a black and white kind of faded photo. When I hear this record, it sounds like black and white faded War on Drugs. As in, everything's in place, but it's still, it's the prototype.
It is, yeah. And I think, if you look at the credits on this, so the only remaining members of the band who play on Wagon Wheel Blues are Adam Grandchiel and Dave Hartley, the bassist. But notably, Dave Hartley only plays bass on tracks 1 and 2. Kurt Vile is still in the band at this point in time. He only plays on 3 tracks. I definitely agree with you. This is the most Dylan War on Drugs album that there is, even though a lot of what the War on Drugs have done since then has been kind of rooted in kind of the best parts of Dylan in the 80s. I think we would both agree that a lot of where the War on Drugs are successful is more in a Neil Young, Tom Petty, Dire Straits type of world, Bruce Springsteen type of world as well. To me, the 3 songs that really stand out here are Arms Like Boulders, the album opener, which immediately feels like a War on Drugs song. A Needle in Your Eye, number 16, which we were texting back and forth, absolutely needs to return to War on Drugs setlist. What an incredible song. In many of the same ways that Arms Like Boulders did in 2015. And then the 10-minute penultimate track on the record, Show Me the Coast. Just a fascinating wall of sound experimentation. This is Grandchiel and Vile kind of working together with whatever gear, whatever technology they had at the time, and you hear the brief hint at Kurt Vile's 2009 record, Childish Prodigy, as well as just hints of where Adam is going to take the War on Drugs and subsequent records.
Don't they do Coast Reprise is the 3rd song, so they do the reprise before they actually do Show Me the Coast.
Yeah. It's great. So we jump ahead 2 years, and we should note there are EPs very much worth hearing. Barrel of Batteries came out pre-Wagon Wheel Blues, and Future Weather came out pre-Slave Ambient, which would come out in August 2011. Future Weather is definitely worth hearing, but for the purposes of time, Slave Ambient, the 2nd LP from the War on Drugs, kind of feels like where the War on Drugs really become the War on Drugs, for lack of a better term. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's the leap from Pablo Honey to the Bends.
Yeah.
This is where you put it on, you get the War on Drugs, the big widescreen sound that just sounds like they had a much bigger budget than on Wagon Wheel Blues. You know, it's clear. I mean, it's clearer, it's crisper. There's still some of like the hazy organ, for example. The 2nd-to-last song on this record is an instrumental called Original Slave that kind of sounds like it could have been on a Wagon Wheel Blues. But this is more clear-eyed. And this also has the song, the track Baby Missiles, which is probably one of those songs that's kind of the test. If you could hear Baby Missiles and you don't get up and want to jump up in the air and punch the sky and be happy that you're alive, then not only will you not like anything else the War on Drugs does, but you're kind of a dick.
Yeah, this is so this was my introduction to the War on Drugs. Best Night was the first.
Me too.
Yeah, this was, I think a lot of people who love the War on Drugs found them through this. It got some promotion from Pitchfork, and it just felt like a really realized record. In, we talked about 2011 a couple of months back, that there were a lot of our favorite artists released records that we didn't totally love in 2011. And the War on Drugs releasing Slave Ambient was kind of an indication of, okay, this is one of the next steps in where indie rock music is going to go. Of note, Dave Hartley is still, he's all over this record playing bass. Robbie Bennett joins and plays piano, acoustic guitar, as well as some percussion. This is the last War on Drugs record with Kurt Vile. But I think, you know, two things happen on this, actually three things happen on this record. One, you noted it, the production is notably improved and you hear the Heartland Americana rock sound that Adam is going to go for. And notably that synths will be involved. This is not 70s rock. This is dipping its toes closer into 80s rock, which is something that in 2011 America was not very well celebrated. The second thing is you get a lot of the songs that are going to define early War on Drugs and will remain in set lists are here. Baby Missiles, Best Night, I Was There, Come to the City. These are songs that will really define War on Drugs set lists for the next 5 or 6 years, and some of which still remain as like the songs that people want to hear when they go to a War on Drugs show. The third thing is you really get this thematic through line of like where Wagon Wheel Blues feels like a lot of a collection of songs. Slave Ambient feels like a fully conceived record that it would still take them one more record to like make a full classic, but there's clearly a sense of a journey that Grandest Heal wants to take you on, where you hear Best Night, and between that and Blackwater Falls, he wants to take you on a very well-constructed path that will be something you can revisit over and over and over again. So that's where you get a lot of the segues. You get a lot of the kind of instrumental tracks that bridge one idea to another that works really well here on Slave Ambient. So Slave Ambient comes out in 2011. It's, I don't know if I would call it a hit. I don't think you could really make a rock hit in 2011. It definitely raises the profile of the War on Drugs. It raises their live profile.
It whet the appetite for us to come next. Like people were anticipating album number 3.
Yes. As Adam has talked about, though, he toured a ton in 2011 off of Slave Ambient. And then he had a really hard time after the tour was finished adjusting to everyday life. He started to spiral into emotional distress, physical manifestations, depression, paranoia, all of which you've got to imagine where he was at in life at the time. This is 10 years ago, so early 30s, trying to figure out, you know, am I really going to make this? You know, am I going to be loading and unloading a van for the rest of my life? Is this record the peak of what I can do? And that kind of fear, that anguish, that depression, that paranoia all starts to lead to the lyrics and the music that he would work on for the next 2.5 years as he built one of my favorite records of all time, the masterpiece that he's made thus far, the best record of the 2010s, according to me, Lost in the Dream. David, you have the floor. What are your thoughts on the third record from the War on Drugs, Lost in the Dream?
Lost in the Dream is a classic click album, as in that's the one where you hear the click. Everything he's been trying to do, all of his ambitions, all the production, all of the synths with shimmering psychedelic production with shoegaze tones and driving drums, everything he's wanted to do comes together, and holy shit, is it glorious. This is, yeah, I still think this is his best record. I don't know if he's capable of topping it, and that's fine because, you know, some records are just classics that are just meant to stay that way. But God, from like the very first song, from Under the Pressure all the way to In Reverse, there's nothing to skip. It flows. It's probably the greatest driving record of the past 30 years. I could go on and on, but I know this album, it also holds a personal spot in my heart because it really, I think it came out about, what was it? I know it came out in 2014. Was it the summer 2014?
It was March 2014.
All right, March 2014. Okay, we had our first child in October of 2014. So we played the heck out of this record leading up to the birth of our first child, Hannah, in October 2014. So it made sense to us when she turned one in October 2015 that the War on Drugs were playing Radio City Music Hall that week. So as kind of a gift to ourselves, we called up a babysitter and saw like a ton of rock shows to celebrate her one-year anniversary. I mean, her first birthday, one of which was the War on Drugs. And that was it was a great show. But, I mean, there's nothing finer to me than driving down the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn under the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, going very fast, listening to An Ocean in Between the Waves. Because if you have an open stretch of highway and you can listen to that song and drive any slower than the 75 miles per hour, then you're a better man than I.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as we'll get into here with the next two records, I think both A Deeper Understanding and I Don't Live Here Anymore are still, they're both responses in many cases to Lost in the Dream. And I think it's the dream of any artist to make a record like this. It perfectly matches his technical abilities, his rising budget, but still like not major label budget, his ambitions, where he was at in life at this point in time, mid-30s, you know, trying to figure out exactly where the next step in his life was going to be. And all of it is thrown into a record that averages 5.5 minute long songs and doesn't waste a single note. There's not a moment on this record that you're like, ah, you kind of went a little long there, even though there were a lot of 7, 8, 6 minute long songs. Personally speaking, this record came out the day before I turned 29. I was in Vietnam on a four-month trip with my wife, traveling around Southeast Asia, India, and Europe. It was a life-affirming, just life-changing trip before we came back to the United States, settled down, had kids, did all that sort of stuff. This record connected me with my dad, with my brother. My uncle passed away unexpectedly while I was overseas, and this record was like a, you know, soothing, calming moment for me as I kind of experienced that grief from afar. When I came back to America, this record was played at set break and pre-show at most Fish shows that I saw that summer. So it was clear that like this record was everywhere, just like ingrained in the world that I was living. As I was trying to kind of start a new career and move in a different direction, as we moved to a different part of the country, this record was there for me. Like every step that I took in 2014, 2015, all leading up to having my first kid in September, of 2015, like this record was there for me. And it was the kind of record that like, if I ever needed music to listen to for whatever reason, I put it on. And, as a result, it's definitely the most important record I've listened to in the last probably 20 years at this point in time. It's a record that I hold in esteem, as you know, this is what I want to hear out of music. And I will say the last thing about this record is, I've said this before, but it's worth noting again, when Dave and I recorded our first episode back in March of 2017, we were talking about the Camden Choctaw's Torture from 1999. And I selected Burning as a track I wanted to use to recommend. And we had never talked about the War on Drugs at that point in time. And I said at one point in the recording, Is this a classic album? And Dave's immediate response, without holding a breath, was, oh yeah, it's a fucking classic. And I knew right then that we could talk about music unending. So we have that. Before we turn this into a Lost in the Dream podcast, we have two more albums to get through. 2017's A Deeper Understanding, which came out during our first year of podcasting. What are your thoughts on this record?
Very good record. A little denser than Lost in the Dream. Not quite as lithe, a little heavier on less bangers and more kind of slow, drawn-out guitar solo-y songs. I like it a lot. I don't listen to it nearly as much as I listen to Lost in the Dream. But, I mean, this one, my favorite song is probably the midpoint, the, like, 11-minute psychedelic walking through the woods guitar excursion, thinking of a place, which was the first single, actually. That was the first thing he dropped was the big, big epic centerpiece for the album. Yeah, it's funny. I have friends that they say, I'll try to listen to a deeper understanding. I'm not a huge fan of the War on Drugs. And I say, go back and listen to Lost in the Dream. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay, now I like the War on Drugs. So now I'll go back and listen to a deeper understanding. It's kind of like, I don't know, to me, it's although it was almost like I had to listen to the Hold Steady's Boys and Girls in America before I was really able to appreciate, what was it, Separation Sunday that came before it. I could see if a deeper understanding was your first War on Drugs experience, you might not be quite as jazzed as if you'd heard Lost in the Dream first. That being said, it still has all of the grandiose hallmarks, which is to say it's really like meticulously put together. It's got tons of synths and drum machines and like density. And, you know, it's by any objective standard a very good record. I actually like it as much as the one that came before it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, I think, you know, it's a fascinating accomplishment. He was able to turn a masterpiece of a record into a major label deal. The War on Drugs personnel is finalized here as Robbie Bennett, Adam Grandshiel, Charlie Hall, Dave Hartley, Anthony LaMarca, and John Natchez. Plus, there's a number of additional musicians that that play on this record. That said, like, you know, this record was interesting in the sense that the first single we heard was Thinking of a Place that felt like, oh, wow, you took the Lost in the Dream sound and you added this like gloss to it and then you blew it up and expanded it. And it sounds like something that you want to just drive across the desert at dusk listening to, like, wow. And then they released four additional singles off of the record. And it felt like going into the...
Yeah, that was part of... I'll stop you right there. That was part of the problem. The run-up, by the time you got the record, everyone had already heard half of it.
Right, right. And I would kind of argue the songs that they released were the best... Aside from In Change, which was not released, the songs that they released were probably the best songs on the record, being Up All Night, Pain, Strangest Thing. And I think that they released Holding On, which... is not my favorite record or song on the record. So like the majority of the songs you heard already were like the strongest moments of the record. You just needed to hear everything in a like full piece. And so it was slightly underwhelming in that standpoint. That said, like, A, I don't know how you follow up Lost in the Dream. And B, I don't know how you follow up Lost in the Dream better than A Deeper Understanding. So I think at the end of the day, all it comes down to is A Deeper Understanding is not Lost in the Dream. And to me, the thing I love about Lost in the Dream, beyond the personal impact that it had on me, is the rough around the edges ambition. And as much as I love and I think A Deeper Understanding is a massive accomplishment, I just kind of prefer that, like, you can hear the band tinkering in Under the Pressure, and you can hear that song almost crack Under the Pressure, if you will, like the sonic elements of it, whereas there's something about A Deeper Understanding that just, it works, and it feels like you push a button and you get these beautiful sounds. I know it's way more intricate than that, I admit that, but like it feels like a record that comes to you fully formed, whereas you can almost hear elements of Lost in the Dream being built as you're listening to it. So we both liked this record when it came out. We both have listened to it. It, I think, you know, at the end of the day, it is not Lost in the Dream, and that's its only fault. And you can't really fault the record for that. But we've waited 4 years, and we got the follow-up to A Deeper Understanding with I Don't Live Here Anymore, which is just an amazing album title for a War on Drugs record. This has been out for just over a week. I've listened to this a number of times. David, you have the floor. What are your thoughts on I Don't Live Here Anymore?
What a sparkly record. This is, you can never accuse the war on drugs of being not bright, but even still, I mean, to this record sounds like if you had like a sinus infection and you've had like just your head has been kind of stuffy for a while and it goes away and you're like, whoa, there really is a difference. And this sounds like an M83 album. This is, it kind of lifts a film off of the war on drugs I didn't really even know was there until you hear this. Like, it just is very, it's clear-eyed. And to me, the big difference between this and the prior albums is that the vocals are actually clearer and easier to understand. And it actually sounds like Grandshaw, while he was never a bad singer, he's always a fine vocalist, now he's almost like putting effort into enunciate, and the vocals are higher mixed, and it's almost like he's consciously trying for like 80s pop hits, like the title track, which I think is one of the best poppiest songs he's done to date. I mean, I could imagine going into like CVS and hearing that song for the next 5 years and being totally happy with it. But yeah, this kind of, it takes Lost in a Dream and makes it poppier, a little clearer, a little easier to consume, and it just, whereas in the past there was like 80s tribute, now it sounds like he's actually gone back to see how he can recreate stuff like Don Henley's solo record, stuff like Phil Collins' Face Value on the fourth song, I Don't Want to Wait, which sounds far more like Phil Collins than it does Paula Cole. It just, obviously, we've only had this record for a week. I've been spinning it nonstop. Everyone talks about how awesome it is when the drums come in on the song Old Skin, which, yeah, that's one of those cathartic war on drugs moments that you live for. I think it's great. I've got no complaints so far, and I just, it's a main line of sparkle to your dome.
Yeah, you know, it's noticeable. So A Deeper Understanding was 66 minutes. Lost in the Dream was 60. This album is 52 minutes. It's like they've cut any fat out of War on Drugs songs, which, you know, yeah, we did say, and I will reiterate, I don't think that there's a wasted note on Lost in the Dream. 60 minutes is what it should have been. But this feels like they've taken the approach to Lost in the Dream and tightened it up in a way that just feels like a major accomplishment for the band. I think you're absolutely right. It's a sparkly record. It's a tight record. You know, this is notably the first War on Drugs record to not have any semblance of an instrumental interlude. These are the songs, and the songs speak for themselves. And as a result, there's a lot of layered ideas within them, which allows ballads like Living Proof, I Don't Want to Wait, Rings Around My Father's Eyes to kind of shine in a way that they didn't as much on A Deeper Understanding. A Deeper Understanding noticeably ends with two ballads, Clean Living and You Don't Have to Go. And it is 13 minutes of ballads to conclude the record. And it tends to feel like 13 minutes of ballads to end the record. This, when the ballads come in, there's so much happening below the surface. There's so much since Robbie Bennett and Adam's work on the synthesizer is just absolutely incredible. To me, the standout tracks are Harmonious Dream, Victim, I Don't Live Here Anymore, Old Skin, and Occasional Rain. Those are the songs I keep coming back to as much as possible. I'm really excited to hear how this impacts them from a live standpoint, because for the first time, you know, if you've seen the War on Drugs, you know that they really, really recreate their live sound incredibly well in a live environment. I'm really curious to hear how these songs come across live, because they just sound so crafted for the studio.
Just what, briefly touching upon what you said with those ballads, it's worth noting that because Grandchild cares so much about album structure, each of the last three War on Drugs albums, the last three songs all kind of function the same way, going from Barn Burner to Resigned Ballad to Hopeful Ballad. And that template is followed here with the song Wasted, then Rings Around My Father's Eyes, and Occasional Rain, which kind of, if you go back to the other two records, it's kind of follows the same way. But yes, I'm very excited to see how these songs translate to the live setting, especially Harmonious Dream. That's going to kill on stage. They're playing Madison Square Garden in January. So that's that makes perfect sense.
MSG, and then they're coming out here to Denver, and they're playing at the Mission Ballroom, one of my favorite places to see music, and a place that should be excellent for them. We should touch just very, 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 very briefly on the November 2020 release of Live Drugs, which was the live album that the band released, kind of culminating all of the work that they had done between, I would call it, 2014 and 2019 as a live band. Very similar to their studio records, the work that the band did, that Adam did to tinker within live performances was brilliant and added a element to these live shows that felt like they were studio performances performed in front of a crowd. I don't know, it was fascinating. It felt like a very classic live album. I loved it, and the performance of Under the Pressure on there is just stunning. So with that, that concludes our War on Drugs talk. We will still talk about the War on Drugs. You know that. We're always going to still talk about the War on Drugs.
We will.
But we hope you enjoyed our deep dive into the War on Drugs discography, and we are going to go to new albums next. All right. So thank you for hanging with us here on this week's episode of The Drop. We're going to talk quickly about new albums. We're not going to do any deep dive into the 1950s at this point in time. We're kind of figuring out what our last segment of the show is going to look like here for the remainder of the year. We got some ideas, but we did want to give you some new records to listen to over the next week. Dave, what is the new album that you are recommending?
New album is from a band Los Angeles, I think, called Dummy. The album is called Mandatory Enjoyment, not to be confused with Weird Al Yankovic's Mandatory Fun. And the song we're going to play is the second track called Fissured Ceramics. So this is a band I would call mid-fi psychedelic rock. It touches upon a lot of things I love, namely droning organs, choppy, loud, velvet underground-style guitars, ethereal female vocals with some elements of shoegaze. I've heard in some circles it's being called like record collector rock, which, you know, sure, if you enjoy Yola Tango, you will find a lot of things to like here. But what's good is that it touches on a bunch of styles in a good 39-minute runtime. It's a very airy-sounding record, and it's got excellent vocals, lots of droning organ, chopping up guitar, and I'm kind of at a loss to say much more other than the fact that if you enjoy kind of like psychedelic garage rock and you plan on doing stuff like seeing Yola Tango's Hanukkah shows coming up, I am. This is your record.
All right, so I'm going to recommend a album from an artist that I've been listening to for probably the last half decade who has contributed to a number of different projects I've enjoyed, and that is Meg Duffy, who records under the name Hand Habits with a number of other musicians. Meg Duffy has notably recorded on the War on Drugs records we just talked about, Ways Blood, William Tyler, as well as was in Kevin Morby's live band for a number of years. And I saw Meg Duffy play with Morby a few times and just did an incredible, incredible work adding backing guitar to his songs. The new Hand Habits record is called Funhouse, and it is a shock, shock great record. I've long enjoyed Hand Habits records. Wildly Idle was a fantastic album from 2017, and close listeners will note that I recommended Yes And from mid 2021, which Meg Duffy collaborated with Joel Ford for a kind of ambient, drony Americana record that I just loved. But Funhouse just came out, and there are synths, there are gated drums, there are hooks. There's so much on this record that I never expected from a Hand Habits record, especially since I didn't love 2019's Placeholder. I can't recommend this enough. I listened to it for the first time earlier this week and was just totally taken by it. One thing I will note is that the lead song on this record, which we are going to play, which is called More Than Love, begins with a line that can only be a testament to Bruce Springsteen's Tougher Than the Rest, one of my absolute favorite songs of all time, a Heartland rock classic. And hearing Duffy sing, "It's Saturday Night and I'm All Dressed Up in Blue," over synths and gated drums of their own doing is just fascinating. So we're going to listen to a bit of More Than Love off of Hand Habits' new record, Funhouse.
All right, folks, you've gotten this far. Thank you very much for hanging with us on The Drop. We talked the war on drugs. We talked spoons, spiritualized. We talked some Fish Halloween. We talked some basketball. We gave you some new records to listen to, some new podcasts to check out. So please come back next Monday. We'll hold hands. We'll enjoy our morning commute. We will all join together and listen to The Drop.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. and our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes. We've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Chris Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.